Rich Kimball here. And Bruce Pratt joining us for Sports Lit 101. And happy to have with us the author of a book that we talked about recently, and we'll get into more details today, of Changing on the Fly. We're joined by author Courtney Zito. Courtney, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us a little backstory on what led you to writing this book?
A little thing called a PhD thesis, basically. The book is basically the result of my PhD dissertation, but from day one, my PhD supervisor had advised me if I had wanted it to be a book format, I should do that from the very get-go. So he very smartly advised me to write it not like a traditional thesis, and to kind of weave a narrative together, and that meant that I didn't have to do so much editing on the back end.
Well, it reads like a book, which is great. And as someone who teaches at the University of Maine, I've read a PhD thesis or two. The dissertation I would pass on. That it's so well written. What I really found interesting, I've long believed that what people believe is less interesting than why they believe it. And I teach hockey lit, so I've been following the changes in hockey attitudes, if you will, in Canada. You chose to pick a segment of the population which could have been invisible for a long, much longer time than it has been in hockey. And how did you make that decision?
I think some of these projects, the best ones, they tend to choose you as opposed to you choosing them. So it's kind of a compilation of a few things. That I grew up in North Delta in Vancouver, BC. That's a heavily South Asian population. And when I was looking for a PhD project, the Hockey Night Punjabi broadcast was getting increasingly popular. And I was like, oh, how did I not know about this as a hockey fan? This seems pretty cool. And then it brought me back to kind of the days that I worked at Sport Check, which maybe is equivalent to your folks like Dick's Sporting Goods, suiting up a lot of Canadian youngsters for the game of hockey. And there were some instances where there's one particular instance where a South Asian boy wearing a Patka, a small turban, we just couldn't find a helmet to fit him, but like cost didn't seem an issue for this family, which is usually the discussion that we have around barriers to hockey. So there was something else kind of keeping him from the game. And I always wondered if, you know, they went to another store the next day, or they came to some sort of compromise, and, or maybe he just never got to play the game. So it was a personal experience that kind of stuck with me. And then when the NHL's Hockey is for Everyone campaign came out around 2011, the name of it kind of invoked that memory. I was like, is hockey for everyone? So just a bunch of different things coming together to ask a question that I thought nobody else was telling. So why can't I tell that story?
Well, if we go back to the earliest hockey fiction that I'm aware of, you know, hockey was supposed to be the way that immigrants became Canadians. And we can go all the way back to Scott Young's Bill Spunska stories. But the immigrants were always from Northern and Western Europe. Those were the people that were going to come to Canada and learn to be Canadian through hockey. And there was always the schism between my Quebecois ancestors and non-Quebecois people. Now you've got Canada is so much more diverse ethnically, religiously than it was before. Is hockey expanding at a rate that it's taking these people in, or is it still very exclusionary?
There's a couple of things going on there. So I think part of it is just the mythology that we have around hockey is exactly what you said, is that it's supposed to be a Northern European game for white folks, and everybody else is just, we're adding them in at a later date. Through my research, I realized that was far from the truth. We've been telling a doctored story about hockey's history in Canada to fit a particular narrative. The Colored Hockey League of the Maritimes is an integral part of hockey's history in Canada and is in large part why we have one of the fastest games that we have today, with, you know, players in that league using forward passing, including the slap shot. Goalies were allowed to play the puck, which we just didn't have at that time. So with the Colored Hockey League of the Maritimes and also Indigenous contributions to basically the hockey stick that we use today, the history of hockey is very multicultural, but kind of if we build off this idea that the winners of history get to tell that story, they weren't the winners of history. So their story got sidelined, diminished. And so we're, some of the work that I try to do today is really just trying to re-inject things that were already true about hockey so that people have a more comprehensive understanding of it. So yes, I think that changing demographics in Canada certainly play a role in it, but I think we would be mistaken to say that, you know, folks are new to the game if they are non-white fans.
Well, in that book, Black Ice, that detailed so much of the other colored hockey leagues of the Maritimes, one of the things that I thought, I found, it just stunned me. I remember sitting back at my desk is, all right, these black people are descendants of loyalist slaves and servants. Mm-hmm. So there is a piece of slavery in Canadian hockey history, or world hockey history, that I knew nothing about, and I know a fair amount about hockey.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's part of the aspect that maybe we wanted to downplay in Canadian hockey history, that a significant aspect of it is black and American and comes from enslaved folks who came north. So I think that it starts to unravel this notion of Canadian history, and that we were supposed to be racially quite different from the United States. And I think when you actually look into the stories, they are unfortunately very similar, certainly unique in context, but they are very similar. So if that's the thing that we hang our hat on as Canadians, is that we're not the United States, we're a multicultural haven, then hiding stories like that really puts those things under the microscope.
We're talking with Courtney Seto here on Downtown about her book, Changing on the Fly. I would think, though, that telling this story, yes, the roots certainly challenge what many people believe to be the history, but at the same time, it is a celebration of diversity.
Yeah, and I think that that's what we're hoping comes out of it today. But I think some of the barriers that we face are when we say that history has been written, and we don't like to change those histories. So I was talking to George Fosse, one of the authors of Black Ice, a few weeks ago, and he was telling me that when their book came out, Barnes & Noble had put it in the fiction section. And they had to phone Barnes & Noble and say, no, this is actually a work of nonfiction. So it's little things like that where we just assume, well, it's a story about black men playing hockey. That can't be true. And if we inject it into today's narrative, we have trouble understanding that that could be a truth, or that, you know, black folks and white folks could play hockey at the same time, and that both of things can be true. So it's just really about nuancing the things that we thought we knew.
When you talk about East Asian and South Asian people, and a number of the people in the book are Sikhs, we also bring in the fact that not only do these people look differently, dress differently than a lot of Canadians, but their religion is not something that's well understood by most people anywhere in the world. I was a religious studies major as an undergraduate, and I know a little bit about the Sikh tradition. But when I asked people, and I did this when I knew you were coming on, they had no idea. They said, well, don't they carry those knives and stuff? They had them confused with Gurkhas. Are Sikhs becoming more visible in Canada in a way in which they are understood as part of the Canadian fabric? Or are they still viewed with that sort of, they're odd, they're different, they're the other?
I think it's both of those things. So I think that the Sikh population in Canada is definitely growing and increasing in prominence with respect to like political circles and media spaces. That being said, I think that they're still generally conceived of as different, other, and always foreign, right? Like we have a long history of Sikh immigration in Canada. So we have many, many generations that are multi-generational families, but you know, we still get those things of where are you really from, or hockey players saying that folks will assume that they don't speak English, even though they've been born and raised in Canada. So there's definitely still those microaggressions and those kind of more subtle aspects of racism that we still need to confront head on.
When I was reading the book, one of the things that really rocked home to me was the fact that hockey is a sport that if your kids are going to play it, you have to be a dedicated parent in a different way than certain other sports. And since schools in Canada are not where most kids play hockey as it would be here, you're putting all this extra economic burden on families. Has anything been, I mean, I keep hearing how this is going to change, but it would seem to me that if unless Canadian schools sort of adopt sports as part of the curriculum, then you're sort of can be pushed to an outside by being an outsider simply by how much money your family has, or whether they can take the time to be a hockey dad, hockey mom.
Yeah, that's absolutely one of the main issues that we have here. And like, I never got to play hockey growing up because there was one girls' league at that time. It was 7 a.m. practices, and both my parents worked downtown, so they're going in the opposite direction. Nobody could get me to hockey. We have a two-tiered system, basically, of sport funding in Canada. And Hockey Canada recently presented at an anti-racism incubator I had on this weekend. And somebody brought up the question of, well, is Hockey Canada going to rejig the way they look at the balance sheet? Because about 18% of their funding goes to national teams and 7% goes to grassroots development. So how do you expect to have high-performing national teams if you're not spending enough money to make sure that you have a pipeline that is coming up through the system? So we don't have it in the school system. What we do have is kind of like one-off patchwork things like the first shift program where we're trying to bring kids in. You get like 6 weeks of introductory hockey and some equipment. But that still doesn't mean that you're going to get into that mainstream system. And then it becomes so expensive very quickly. It's become more about creating elite hockey players as opposed to just getting people to fall in love with the game so that they can enjoy it for the rest of their life. I mean, we have things in Canada where we have rep hockey, which is our kind of top tier, most competitive minor hockey. But we have 5 tiers of it in certain places. And you know what? If you're playing 5th tier rep hockey, you're not really playing rep hockey. But it becomes a way to bilk parents and families out of extra money because they think that they're in the high-performance system. So I think we've just kind of really lost track of the values that are supposed to go with the sporting system. And until we fix that, it's still going to be a very exclusive game. And we potentially are going to run out of folks to fill those national teams in a competitive way. We're certainly seeing that with Canada and U.S. women's. Like, the American women's team is very, very solid. I'm always scared when we go up against them. So there is something in the development system in the States that I think is working better than it is up here.
Angie Abdu, who's a friend of ours and a friend of the show, wrote a great book called Home Ice about her sort of conflicted feelings about youth hockey in Canada and her son Ollie playing. One of the things, we don't see that as much here with hockey as we do with basketball and soccer, where it becomes a year-round kind of adventure. But are you finding too that it's more and more difficult to convince parents that they should invest in one sport, that a kid at age 9 should decide, boy, it's going to be hockey because that's your sport? Are you seeing that kind of blowback? Because we're seeing that here.
Absolutely. And I've heard the national team coaches and players talk about the younger players that are coming up and they don't know how to, you know, throw a ball. They don't know how to kick a ball because they've only ever played hockey. And I have friends who I play hockey with that their kids are in hockey and they want them to play multiple sports, but they can see once they pull them out for, you know, a few months or a year that there's a huge development gap. And so it puts a fear into parents that they're maybe messing up their kids' opportunity at a scholarship or something like that if they're not dedicated to 6-7 day a week practices, power skating, games, off ice development, and things like that. And Hockey Canada and the coaches will tell parents that you need to diversify your kids' sporting experiences. We want multi-sport athletes, but if it comes to drafting kids at 14, and those 14-year-olds are better because they've been playing, you know, 6-7 days a week, then that's not really reinforcing the message very well. So it's kind of fear on multiple factors about getting left behind in the system. And then therefore we end up doing the things that are not necessarily beneficial for the athletes or our development programs.
Courtney, by the way, we appreciated your Twitter shout out to the greatest fictional hockey player in Maine history.
I mean, yeah, Julie the Cat Gaffney is probably my first experience of knowing that Bangor, Maine existed. So, you know, it's an important part of hockey film history.
Absolutely. Well, Courtney, thank you so much. We love the book and appreciate you making time for us here this afternoon.
I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
That's Courtney Zito. The book is Changing on the Fly on Sports Lit 101. And Bruce, what's coming up next week on Sports Lit?
Next week, we're going to go a place we went before in a different kind of way. The book is called Passing the Baton, Black Women Track Stars and American Identity. And one of the books that we talked about a couple of years ago that we like, Representing Wilma Rudolph by Rita Liberty and Maureen Smith, is quoted often in this. It's a history of black female athletes and how they were how hard it was for them to get a fair shake on our Olympic teams and national teams. And it's pretty interesting because I bet if I ask almost 100% of the people in the track and field community in Maine, who was the first African-American woman to win an Olympic medal, not a gold medal, that almost none of them would know. And I bet maybe only 15% would know the first one to win a gold medal. And those were things that happened not much longer. I mean, I started watching the Olympics in 1960, you know, Wilma Rudolph and Wyoming Attias going forward. This goes back before that to the 40s and early 50s and how black women were forced to behave a certain way. It's a really interesting book, and it's really a championing of some great athletes.
And boy, this just arrived today. You'd mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. I can't wait to read it from Eric Sherman. Two Sides of Glory, the 1986 Boston Red Sox in their own words.
Oh, good. You got yours today?
I did.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes, I am. I think mine should arrive today, too.
All right. That's coming up on Sports Lit 101.